We all experience failure at some point in our lives, whether it's failing a driver's test or getting fired from a job. In that moment, you might feel like your life is over. But our next guest argues that failure could be good for you. In fact, even a critical component of your development as a resilient human being. Neil Pasricha is the author of the book, You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, and Live an Intentional Life. He joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I love this title because it seems so inconsistent with what the book is about.
Mm.
You Are Awesome sounds like Stuart Smalley from Saturday Night Live with his, you're good, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me.
Should we call it, I know, maybe we should call it You Are Not Awesome.
You Are Not Awesome. No matter what anybody says, you are resilient.
I don't know if that would have got by the sales and marketing team.
You are resilient, it could be.
Yes, yes.
So what is this book about?
Here's the thing. We live in an era of infinite abundance. We've got longer lifespans, higher education rates. We've got it. You can press a button on your phone and the car picks you up, drives you home. By the time you get home, you got steaming takeout on your porch because you ordered it from your car. Your phone's entertaining you. We live better than kings lived 50 years ago. We live like kings.
Yeah.
Like my kids have three pillows in their bed. That's disgusting. But like, I'm just like, we live better than anyone. But then at the exact same time, because we live like kings, we have not developed tools to handle failure or even perceived failure. You put your kids in cello classes now, and then you just push them up and with gold stars and participation ribbons till they succeed at whatever they're doing. I talked to a high school teacher yesterday, no joke, emailed me, and he's like, I can't put kids in failure situations anymore because the parents won't allow
it. They'll go insane.
We got to have perfect resumes, otherwise they won't get into the fancy schools. So here's the problem. Now when you get three likes on your photo, you think, you got no friends. And you get a rude email from your boss, you call in sick the next day. No wonder we got 1 in 3 college students with clinical anxiety. Those anxiety rates, by the way, are up 30% over the past 5 years.
You and I are parents now, so we have skin in this game because we don't want to raise kids who are like this. How do you—
And I'm like this too.
Are you really?
Yes, I'm very thin-skinned.
Really?
Yeah, I'm fragile. I wrote this book for me. And the side benefit is my kids might read it.
Really? Because I wonder how this sells to the snowflakes out there. And you're saying it sells because you are yourself,
well,
a snowflake.
And part of what I'm trying to do with the book, Bruce, is like teach people how to build in some of that musculature. I call it resilience. You know, that's a big buzzword these days. But I'm like, okay, if everyone taught you till you're 22 years old that you're perfect— then how do we build in some of this mental strength?
How on earth did you become one of those people based on your family of origin? Your mom was born in Kenya. She moved to England. She had an arranged marriage, moved to Canada. She had like every extraordinary experience to build resilience. And she didn't pass it on to you? Give me her number. I am calling her because she has failed.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I said to the high school teacher when he emailed me yesterday, it's like, well, you got to let your kids fail. You got to put them in situations where they don't do well or they don't get first place or they suck at something because that's how you build that musculature. We don't let people do that. And you're right. My mom did come here scrapping and saving. My dad scrapping and saving from India. And they tried their whole life to give my sister and I a perfect childhood.
Right.
Don't you want your kid to be happy?
Of course.
So what do you do for them? Don't you buy them nice clothes and put them in a good school and always like take care of them? Like you got skin in the game. You just said you got skin in the game. So what are you doing to build failure in your kid?
Well, I tell you, here's a great example. I let her get lost at the grocery store.
Like totally lost?
Now, in the retail store near my house, so it wasn't like a superstore. And I said, Abby, if you would like to wander around the store, you need to know where I am. And if you get lost, what do you do? Whatever, whatever. Of course, she gets lost and she's gone for maybe 3 minutes. I can't find her. Another parent finds her. She does this big show of tears, but she's not upset because we had the plan.
Yeah.
And now she failed in a safe environment. So I never worry about her. Abby, what's the rule? You can't find me. You call my phone. What's my phone number? Blah, 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 blah.
Oh, wow.
She's good to go. So she is one of the most independent kids. I think that's partly her temper, partly her temperament.
Yeah.
And partly how amazing I am as a parent. Because really, I mean, it's like I'm extraordinary. So that's an example for me with what Abby, who's now 10, she's probably 5, maybe 6 when we did that. What are some of the connections mm-hmm. to money here. So this is a show about personal finance. There's lots of examples in which people fail. They fail at real estate. They fail at investing. They fail at paying off their credit card debt.
Sure.
What are some of the most compelling connections you would make between your book, your approach, your life philosophy, and personal finance?
Well, here's the thing. In this book, You Are Awesome, I'm trying to teach people ways to build up their resilience. One of the ways I talk about doing that is something called finding small pawns, okay? So, like, you got to put yourself in a game that you can win in order to build up your confidence and your resilience goes up. So I have a chapter in the book called Why You Shouldn't Buy the $5 Million Condo. Have you ever opened up a New York Times magazine or some fancy magazine and says, like, brand new condos on the Hudson River in Manhattan, starting at $5 million? Here's a money connection for you, Bruce. I'm like, who would buy that? You're buying the second floor condo facing the courtyard. You are the loser of the building starting at $5 million. But that would buy you a penthouse suite anywhere else. So we talk about money. Don't put yourself in a game that you are going to lose and feel like a loser. Put yourself in a game that you can win. How did I get this advice? Well, when I went to Harvard Business School, the dean told me, hey, how's it going looking for jobs? And I was like, it sucks. Everyone's trying to get a job at like Google and McKinsey, and it's so hard. And, you know, we got these millionaire bankers with black bags in their eyes, and everybody wants to be one of them. And there's only 10 jobs available, and there's 1,000 of us. He's like, oh, you're looking, you're going to become a small fish in a big pond. And even if you land one of those jobs, you'll be looking over your shoulder forever. So instead, go find the nerd at the library. Don't try to find the hot babe at the beach. And instead, go find someone that isn't flying to Harvard Business School, is more like a broken company or a bankrupt company. That would put you on a path where you can do well once you get inside.
How does that square with the universal wisdom that your income is connected to the income of the five people who are closest to you, the friends that you have? You and I both went to the Queen's University School of Business. It is a very fast crowd. We chose a very aggressive type A place to go to school.
Uh-huh.
And would you say your advice to your kids is don't go to the top business school in the country?
Well, I would definitely say go somewhere where you can be successful. Absolutely. I would not say don't go to the top business school. I would say go wherever you want to go. And I don't even know if you want to go to school. I'm not going to pressure my kids to go to school. They might want to be an artist. They might want to become the world's greatest graffiti painter. I don't know. I can't tell them what they're going to be. But what I can say is put yourself in a game that you can win. You want to do that by putting yourself somewhere where you're, they call it academic self-concept in the research. Put yourself somewhere where you can be a 9 in a group of 5, not a 5 in a group of 9s. Why? Your academic self-concept, which is how you think of yourself, it goes up and it stays up for even more than 10 years after you leave that pond or that experience.
It would almost say that you would recommend parents don't put their kids in the gifted stream.
I would totally recommend. Look, I'm saying tee off at the tees closest to the hole. Sign up for the marathon in the slowest category. Go somewhere where you can win, because just winning helps you develop mental strength.
But doesn't that play into the whole snowflake mentality that we have to win all the time?
No, it's weird. I know it sounds like a paradox, right? It sounds like a paradox. I'm not saying win all the time. I'm saying when you're feeling high anxiety, look, mental illness is up, depression is up, loneliness is up. We feel terrible, Bruce, whether or not you or I feel terrible today, this minute. The society right now is we are not feeling good. What do we need? Resilience. How do we build it? One of the ways to do it is put yourself in small ponds or put yourself in games that you can win so you cheer yourself up. I got one other thing I talk about in the book that's kind of related is I have a 2-minute morning exercise you should start your day with every
day. Tell us about it. I think it's brilliant. Tell us about it.
Well, don't look at your cell phone. Let's start with that. I sometimes go to an audience and they're like, how many people look at their cell phone first thing when they wake up? Every single hand goes up in the air. How many people look at their cell phone before they go to bed? Every single hand goes up there. If you drank a bottle of wine before bed and when you got up in the morning and slept with your bottle of wine on your bedside table, we'd all call you an alcoholic. We're all phonaholics now, and we use that dopamine hit in the morning, and it makes us feel horrible because we're comparing ourselves to everybody else, and it feels bad. So what do? Start with a 2-minute morning practice before you get out of bed. Ask yourself 3 prompts. Super simple. I will let go of, I am grateful for, I will focus on. Would you believe, Bruce, that I actually write these 3 things down every single day?
I would believe it because you're you.
I totally believe it.
What's an example of something you would let go of?
I would let go of today. This book just came out. It's been out less than a week. I don't know if it's going to be on the bestseller list. We don't find out till Wednesday or Thursday. I have to let go of that. I can't determine if it's a New York Times bestseller. That's not up to me. It's up to the New York Times. I have to let go of that. 5 pounds I gained over the holidays, comparing myself to Tim Ferriss, whatever it is. You could let go of whatever you write down. And you know what happens when you write it down? You actually stop thinking about it all day. There's research behind this.
Right.
I am grateful for, we know it's important to prime your brain for positivity, and I will focus on, it's important to carve a will do from the endless should do and could do list that we all have. We have decision fatigue. I will focus on helps us streamline our thinking for the day. Those three little prompts are what I call a 2-minute morning intervention to strengthening your mind.
Super practical. I was talking to a listener 2 weeks ago. A lot is going wrong for her in the area of money. They're still afloat, but a lot's going wrong. How do you call the failure? Because in today's day and age, it's very easy to be failing for long, long periods of time.
Yeah.
Because there's no cataclysmic event, right? Like your marriage, as you've been very public about that first marriage and how suddenly your wife asked for a divorce. Yeah, she left you. So that was a failure, but you were, I'm using air quotes here, failing for a period of time in that marriage. You describe, you know, how that wasn't like hooray for everything all the time.
So let me kind of soak back into that sort of gray muddy area we've been exploring, which is how do we talk to our children? And if you listen to any kid's commencement speech today, there's somebody on stage wearing a cap and gown, getting an honorary degree, saying something like, do what you love, follow your heart, chase your passion. That's what we tell our kids. You know, we should be asking, this is related to your question, we should be asking, do you love it so much you can take the pain and the punishment too? You know, Mark Manson wrote that famous book, Subtle Art of Not Giving. I won't say the swear word.
Yep.
Okay.
Rhymes with duck.
Exactly. Rhymes with duck. He wanted to be a rock star. I've actually heard him talking about how openly he was. He was like, I couldn't handle lugging an amp to a smoky nightclub at 2 a.m. on a Tuesday for 6 years and practicing the 6-chord progression for 6 hours. I couldn't handle that. But getting into Facebook comment wars, that was my jam. I loved doing that. So I became a better writer because I took that pain and punishment along the way. Whatever it is you want to do, ask yourselves if you're up for the stress that goes with it. You and I talk about money. We talk about work stuff. Hey, if you want a new job and you're listening to this, are you up for handing out 100 resumes? Are you up for getting 50 no callbacks? Are you up for going to 25 first-round interviews? Are you up for getting a rejection from 24 of them?
Mm.
That's the pain and the punishment to getting a new job. Are you up for that? If not, you're not going anywhere. You're stuck here forever.
Now, you argue that people should talk more openly about their failures. I understand that theoretically. I think in practice, it's very, very difficult for people to do.
Yeah.
How do you go about doing that for someone who doesn't have the platform that you have? And this is a party.
Yeah.
I mean, it's on brand for you to talk about success and failure. It's who you are. It's a self-expression. But for the average person who's working as a manager in a mid-sized corporation, what do they invite everybody to lunch and talk about their failing marriage?
So I used to. I don't know, you know, I was 10 years at Walmart, right? I mean, in human resources. So I did a lot of time interviewing people. And people aren't usually going to lie on their resume. People won't do that. But you know what they do? Omit. Omit.
Right.
So what you do is you look at the resume. If I'm the interviewer and I'm like, huh, there's a 6-month gap here, you know, after you graduated from college and before you started your job. Or there's a 12-month gap here. So I always picked and prodded at those gaps. You know what I found? Things that people are uncomfortable talking about. They called them failures in their mind. You know what I called them as the interviewer? Crucible moments. That's where they discovered themselves. They went on a trip to India. They became a yoga instructor. I want to know about those. So when you look at your LinkedIn profile, you look at your resume, what are you omitting that you could simply be more public about? You could call it a failure. I call it a failure. But what did you learn from it? Because that's what we really want to get out in the open.
You have a whole bunch of really practical tips. Lose more to win more. Go to parties where you don't know anyone. The thing that caught one of the things that caught my attention is have a failure budget.
Mm.
What does that mean?
So January 1st of every year, I am remarried. For those that don't know my entire life story, I'm remarried. My wife, Leslie, and I've been together for a while now. We have 3 little boys, 5, 3, and 1. Okay. On January 1st of every year, would you believe we do this? We take money from our joint account and we put it into our personal accounts that I can't see hers, she can't see mine. It's our failure budget and also how we buy gifts for each other. Because I don't want to buy her a blender and her say, I don't like this blender and I paid for half of it. That stinks. So what do I do in my failure budget? I just try stuff that I don't know if it's going to work or not. I take a cooking class and something I don't know if I like. I'll go to like a music festival that I've always dreamed about going, but I just don't know if I can pull it off. I do my podcast. My whole podcast, 3 books, is my failure budget. I got no ads, no sponsors, no promotions, nothing. I make no money off it, but it's an experiment to see if the conversations I have in that medium can enable me to become a better person. A failure budget is really important because you shouldn't overthink whether you should spend a little bit of money every year on trying something so far out of your comfort zone that you might enjoy it, and certainly you will learn a lot from it.
So how do you have someone execute on that idea who already has $3,500 outstanding on their credit card, and they can make their minimum payments, but they aren't making headway on that credit card?
So then I say do the number of digits test. Look at your income. Start with, do you have an income? So if you have an income, then move the digits over 3 places. So if you're making $25,000 a year, make $25 your mental failure budget. Like, huh, I'll take a chance and go to this jazz club tonight. I've never listened to jazz before. I don't know if I like jazz. I'll take a chance on it. Maybe I'll take a Rosetta Stone language course to learn Japanese. I love manga, but I never learned Japanese. I'll just take the first course. Try some things that are just a 0.01% of your actual income, so it's a small enough dose that you can handle it, but still put yourself in situations you will be uncomfortable with, because when you know the least, it's when your learning is the steepest.
Untouchable days is another very tangible, practical idea in your book. What is an untouchable day? And what are the excuses that people are already going to have in their mind that you're going to address head
on? So in You Are Awesome, I write about how, ironically, when I was trying to write You Are Awesome, I had no time to write it. I had quit Walmart, and people are like, so how's, now you quit your job, how's the new book coming? And I was like, terribly, because my day just fills. That's what everyone's day does. You think you did nothing. You look at your sent items. You get 147 emails. Or you have all these meetings that you couldn't really get anything done in between. So I took a drastic step, Bruce. I decided to create one untouchable day a week. What's an untouchable day? It's a day where I am literally unreachable, untouchable, uncontactable by anyone at all, including my wife, all day. I mean, I'm in airplane mode. I don't even go on the internet. Nothing. My wife doesn't even know where I am. Why does it work? Because my productivity goes up 10 times. I write 5,000 words on those days. That's how I do my best work. The untouchable day has become a salvation for me. It is the number one way to strengthen your mind and actually get more done. But of course, as you pointed out, when I tell people I do this, they always say, oh, well, easy for you to say. You're a writer because you're a writer, so you could do that. I'm like, no, I'm doing that. I'm a writer because I do that. I'm able to write books because I have that time. Oh, people say, oh, what about emergencies? I'm like, get over yourself. How often does your kid break their leg? Are you kidding me? There's a phone at the school. You don't have to worry about all this stuff. People, nobody had cell phones, okay? Nobody used to have them. You don't need to know where, you don't need to track. I have a friend, him and his wife, they track each other's location all day. I mean, seriously? Don't get me started on this.
I accidentally did.
It's important to go off the grid sometimes and let your thoughts ferment and congeal and release your most inspiring and creative thinking.
So you and I are values aligned on this, absolutely, but we live in a world that is not. We live in a world today in which there are participation medals and there's so much, people would call it compassion and empathy, but you and I might call it an inability to accept failure and a disinterest in developing resilience. How do you think you will talk to your kids in 5 or 10 years that is different than how a parent of a kid that age will talk to their kids about the failure that they received in school or the rejection they got from that girl or that boy or whatever? How do you think that those conversations are going
to
go?
Well, I'm starting those conversations now. Look, my kid is about to go to school next year, and my wife and I have made the very conscious decision. Downtown Toronto, we're surrounded by all these private schools. We're like public school. And you know what? If he has a bad teacher, good. Like, we want him to have the experience of going through education in the sense that you will have good teachers, you'll have bad teachers, you have teachers that fit you, teachers that don't. I'm not going to try to pluck you into a perfect situation every year, because that's the snowplow parent who's making your life easy so that you get like into some Ivy League school or whatever. That's too much. I got to let my kid fail. Kids will naturally fail. They will naturally jump off a thing. They will naturally wander around the grocery store and get lost in the meat aisle or whatever your kid's doing. And that's okay. We have to let our kids fail. Part of what being a parent and how I talk to my parent is hands off. Let them wander. Let them roam. Let them try stuff.
Does your failure budget, are you saving for the therapy budget for your children that they're going
to
need
want my
when
kids
they feel
to
so hard done by?
I want my kids to be
my
in therapy.
My dad was so hardcore, man. He was the worst.
You know what I hate? You know when people say to me, Bruce, they're like, oh, my kid's going to need therapy for that. I say, good. Therapy is like exercise for your mind.
Yeah.
It's actually, I'm in therapy. Everyone I know who's interesting is in therapy. You know what?
Really?
Are you in therapy?
Not currently, but I have.
You should be.
I am a bit.
You're interesting.
Consistently
I'm
in therapy?
Here's what I do. I change the volume. So after my divorce, I was going to therapy twice a week. Now I'm going once every 2 months.
Oh.
Now it's like I save stuff on my iPhone notes of like things to talk about and process. You know what? It's great to process things with a professional. I think of therapy as going to the gym for your mind.
I love it. It's like an intellectual spa. Totally.
And now, here's the thing. It's not always affordable for people, money-wise, and it's not always reachable if you go through the public system. That's partly why that two-minute morning practice I advocate and You Are Awesome is so productive, because I will let go of writing down and crystallizing and injecting anxiety actually helps you process stuff the way a therapist does. I know it sounds simple, but it really does get stuff off your chest.
So inspiring. Clearly you are passionate about this. Is that a fair assessment.
Yeah, I'm really passionate about this. If you aren't passionate about something, you should write a... You spent 10 years, two years writing a book about it.
To change the levels on your microphone here. Neil Pasricha, author of the book, You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, Live an Intentional Life.